Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. This is episode 38. Hey, did you guys know that we are officially a project of 1517 Legacy? We are. You can go over to 1517legacy.com and check out all the stuff they have going on over there. You can check out the articles and the books and other podcasts like Virtue in the Wasteland. You can check out the League of Faithful Mass, all that stuff. And let me tell you this, we have an exciting thing. We have released an audiobook of one of our favorite books, Martin Luther's On the Freedom of a Christian. And we are giving that away for a donation of any amount. You can give a dollar, you can give $100, you can give whatever you want, and you can get this audiobook. We have produced it. Brandon has read it. It's really great. So this is kind of a fundraising campaign. So if you're interested in that, go over to ChristHoldFast.org and you can probably see the banner, or if you're listening to this a while from now, you can go over to the store and you will see the book in the store. All right. That being said, I am joined by Brandon Hansen.
Hey, y'all.
And Mr. Chad Bird.
Morning, everybody. Brandon sounds southern this morning. Hey, y'all.
Hey, y'all.
He's got the Texan coming there.
I lived there for a while. Not in Texas. Yeah.
I'm glad we were able to influence proper speaking.
Proper speaking.
Yes, I learned my proper southern English.
You're second person plural of y'all.
Yeah, yeah. Southern is Chad's job.
I suppose, since I'm speaking to a wider audience than just the two of you, it should have been, hey, y'all, y'all. Is that right?
Yeah, hey,
that
y'all.
Would be more. That would be formal Texas English.
Is that all, okay. All y'all?
All y'all.
All y'all.
Because y'all can mean in reference to one person. All y'all is always plural.
What about that? Isn't the plural of y'all just like yins?
Maybe in certain parts of Texas, but I haven't lived there.
Hey yins, all yins. Okay. That was fun. Chad, where are we at in Genesis?
We are at the beginning of chapter 27. We have the story of the deception of Isaac by Rebekah and her son Jacob to cover today. So it's a lengthy chapter. Lots of good stuff here, though. Should be fun.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so we've encountered more than once now the struggle between these two brothers, Jacob and Esau. And of course, this is like the struggle that we see throughout the scriptures of other brothers, beginning with the first two brothers, Cain and Abel. But it kind of reaches its, I guess it's crescendo here in this chapter. The first time we saw this was when they were both born, because of course, Esau comes out first, Jacob is holding on to his heel. And, he already then is trying to get ahead of his brother to supplant him. And then later on, we saw the episode with the sale of the birthright. Esau comes in from the field. He's famished. Jacob says, hey, I'll give you some of this food if and only if you sell me your birthright, which Esau did. And so Jacob gains possession of his brother's birthright then. But we still have the blessing. The blessing that the father gives to the firstborn son. And that's what the focus of this chapter is on. And a bit of more background is to remind everybody about the perspective of the two parents here. We're told right away when these boys are born, well, after they grow up, this is back in chapter 25, that when the boys grew up, Esau becomes a hunter, Jacob stays at home, and it says Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So we've got parents having a favorite son, and we see this favoritism coming full circle here when finally it's time for Jacob to give his blessing to the firstborn. I mean, Isaac to give his blessing to the firstborn.
Isn't that kind of a strange reason to prefer someone over somebody else? Like, man, Esau.
Is the food you like?
Esau loves that venison. That's my dude.
Like, yeah, he's all culinary. You know, he knows what he likes to eat. It is a rather strange reason.
It is. I mean, he just loves that gamey meat. He's a real man. He's a man's man.
He's a man's man, so he loves his his hunter son.
Does it more imply that I mean obviously we're joking here, but it's got to more imply that he was like sort of like a hunter and like rugged and this kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think that probably he saw himself that Isaac saw himself more in Esau than he saw himself in Jacob is the way that I read that.
And we're going to find out that Jacob's a little smooth.
Yeah, Jacob is smooth in more ways than one.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
He doesn't have the hair that Esau has, but he's also a smooth dealer, highly skilled in deception. His mother is also, well, she's not only part of that, but it's actually her plan to do what he does. So here's what happens. We're jumping ahead here, and Isaac is old, and he doesn't know when he's going to die, but I guess he actually lives quite a bit longer, but he thinks that he is near death, and before he dies, he needs to verbally bless his oldest son. So his eyes are too dim to see. And so he calls his older brother Esau and says to him, "My son." And he said to him, "Here I am." And Isaac goes on to say that he doesn't know the day of his death. And so it's time for him to, it's time for him to give the blessing. So he basically tells him to go hunting and to bring the game back and to prepare it in the way that his father desires it. And then as they eat the meal, he's going to give him the blessing. Now, the detail that is added there that is significant is in that first verse. It says his eyes were too dim to see. I've said this before, that almost every time that a physical characteristic of a person in the Bible is given, it becomes significant as the narrative unfolds. This is unlike modern novels where you'll have a lot of descriptions of characters given simply to kind of give more color to the story. The scriptures are extremely sparse, conservative in their descriptions of the physicality of people. So anytime that you have a physical description given, that is going to play a part later on. And that's what we see here. His eyes are too dim to see. And of course, that becomes the means by which his son is going to deceive him. So after Isaac gives this command to his son, we hear that Rebecca was eavesdropping, kind of like Sarah was eavesdropping when the three men came to visit Abraham and told him about the upcoming birth of Isaac. So here Isaac's wife is listening. She overhears what Isaac says to Esau. And as soon as Esau leaves, Rebecca calls her son Jacob and gives him instructions. Now, this is just a parenthetical comment here, but I think it is interesting when you pay careful attention to the biblical text, these things sometimes jump out at you, because it says in verse 5, "And Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau." It doesn't say their son Esau, to his son Esau. And then in the very next verse, it said Rebekah said to her son, Jacob. Again, not their son, Jacob, but her son, Jacob. So you can see even in the personal pronouns that are used here, his son, her son, that you have a division between the parents here. One is the favorite of the father, one is the favorite of the mother, and that comes out even in the way that their relationship with these boys are designated. So just to kind of summarize what Rebecca says, she says she tells Jacob what she heard Isaac saying, what the plan was. He's about to bless the firstborn. And so she says, here's what you need to do. You go to the flock. You take a couple of kids from there, baby goats. You give them to me. And she's going to prepare this savory dish that she knows that her husband likes. And then he's going to get the blessing because he's going to pretend to be his brother. But Jacob He's thinking this through a little bit more than his mother is, because he says, look, Mom, Esau, my brother, is a hairy guy and I'm a smooth guy. What if my father feels me? Then I shall be as a deceiver in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. Now, I find this fascinating, because here we have Jacob and his mom preparing this elaborate scheme to get the blessing from Isaac. And what's he worried about? He's not worried about whether this is right or wrong. He's not worried about what he's doing to his brother. He's not worried about what he's doing to his father. He's not even worried about his mother's involvement in this scheme. Instead, all he's worried about is getting caught.
Yeah. It's funny that he's like, what if he reaches out, touches me, figures out that I'm not Esau, and then, I mean, he'll think I'm trying to deceive him. It's like, Yeah.
Then I shall be as a deceiver in his sight. Well, I got news for you, guy. That's what you are.
Yeah.
Then he's going to find out that I really am like I really am.
Yeah.
And that would not be good.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It's amazing how we can self-justify as we're in the process of premeditating, you know, whatever sin or crime. It's like, I'm really not that bad. So, what if people found out and they would see what's going on and they wouldn't get it? Like, no, this is like, I'm not really a deceiver. I'm not really trying to deceive you. I'm just trying to deceive you. See?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not trying to deceive you. I mean, I'm just deceiving you. It's all in the,
how can I,
all the tone of voice we use.
How can I deceive Dad into not thinking I'm a deceiver? That's the real question, Mom.
Yeah, we got a double deception going on here. And perhaps behind it all, we have a self-deception going on. So he's lying to everybody, including himself. So he's worried about what's going to happen to him. He's not worried about his dad, his mom, his brother. He has not changed from the moment he left the womb. He's always trying to get ahead of his brother. And here's his chance.
All I know is that in light of what they pull off here, Esau must have been like a really hairy dude.
Yeah, he must have been. I mean, they put these goat skins on Jacob, and of course the father feels that at some point, and so I guess that Esau's skin must have felt like the skin of a goat.
Just like he had straight fur going on, man.
Yeah.
I'm not like really big into conspiracy theories here, but I do believe that Esau's line has carried forth. And today we know the Esaians or whatever, the Edomites, I suppose, right? As a Sasquatch. Sasquatch. They are real.
We have finally found
real, folks.
We have finally found biblical proof for the existence of Sasquatch, right? Yep. Right here in Genesis, people. Right here.
A man who feels like a goat? Come on.
I've got a friend. I don't know if he ever listens to this show, but he loves what is it, hunting Bigfoot or something, finding Bigfoot. Show out there about it. I've never watched it, but he loves it. Like, he gets really into it. I don't think he really believes they're real, but yeah, there we go. They're the Edomites.
We better be careful. They're going to be contacting us as biblical theologians who have proof for the existence of Sasquatch. Trace it all the way back to Genesis.
I can't prove Scott Sasquatch. Goat man? Yeah. Goat. Yes.
Yeah. So we have Goatman here who's out hunting, and here we have Jacob, and he says to his mom, what are we going to do? What if I get caught doing what I'm doing? So his mother comes up with this plan, but first, interestingly, she says, "Your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go get them for me." So she is fully invested in this. She's taken responsibility, even if he is found out and his father is uttering a curse. She says, "Let that curse fall on me." So the mother is not just doing this half-heartedly. She's fully into it. So what happens? Well, Jacob does what she says. He's an obedient son. He goes out. He gets the kids. He brings them to his mom. Mom makes a savory food that her husband loves. And then she took the best garments of Esau, her oldest son, and they were, which were with her in her tent, and she puts them on Jacob. So she dresses him like his brother. She prepares a meal like his brother prepares. And then to top it off, she puts these goat skins on the back of his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. So he's all prepared. I mean, the deception is ready to be tried. So let's see if it works. Jacob goes to his father and he says, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" So right away, Isaac might be old, his eyes might be dim, but he's not dumb. He's all there. And so right away, he knows that something just doesn't seem right. So and this is the first of three times that Isaac is going to say something which implies that he's not at all certain about the identity of the man that he's about to bless. And here we have the first outright lie, verbal lie that Jacob says. I mean, it's just in black and white. Jacob says to his father, "I am Esau. I am Esau, your firstborn. And I have done as you told me. Get up, please sit, eat of my game, that you may bless me." But he's not done yet. Because Isaac says, How is it that you have it so quickly, my son? I mean, you don't just go out. I don't care how good a hunter you are. You know, you don't go out and just, "Oh, there's a deer," and all of a sudden you kill the deer. You bring it home, you cook it, and you bring it. These things take time. This has happened far too rapidly than it should have. So what's Jacob going to say to cover himself here? Well, obviously, the choice will be to take the Lord's name in vain. Because he says, "Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me." What do you think of that?
Ooh.
Yeah, that's pretty low.
You blame God. It's like I remember when I was.
Are you about to confess?
I shouldn't tell this story. I remember when I was like 15. There was this girl that I was dating. And her, oh man, but she was there. She was super, super Christian, and I was a pastor's kid. And I grew up fairly charismatic, so this works better if that's the case. It's not you. I mean, I want to keep this going and stuff. But you know, God just, you know, he just told me that I need to like solely focus on him. You can't argue with that. Like, there's no arguing with it. It's God's fault.
God's breaking your heart, honey. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd date you to the end of time. But
that's going to be the worst breakup line ever.
It really is. Just blame God.
Oh, but it worked, right?
Yeah, you can't argue with that. Like,
well, what are you going to say, right? You cannot argue with that. Yeah, if it were up to me, I would stick with you, but God wants me to end this.
I mean, I love you like crazy, but I love God more, you know, clearly.
Well, the use and the misuse of the Lord's name is not isolated to episodes in Genesis, nor to dating relationships. It happens all the time. In fact, you could see this already. To some extent, in the Garden of Eden, maybe not taking the Lord's name in vain, but we notice that Adam blames God for causing him his problems, right? "The woman whom you gave to be with me." So God is not unused to being pulled into the schemes of man. So we have the second lie here of Jacob. First, he claims to be Esau, and then secondly, he says, because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. But Isaac is not yet convinced. So he says to his son to come closer because he wants to feel him. You know, he might not be able to see, but his hands are still working. And he says, whether you are really my son Esau or not. I think in the back of Isaac's mind, he knows what kind of son Jacob is. A father knows his son. And so in the back of his mind, he's fully aware that from infancy that Jacob has always been trying to get ahead of Esau. And even though he never outright asked him, are you Jacob? His hesitancy seems to have been at least partly fueled by his knowledge of his son's personality. So that's what happens. Jacob comes close to Isaac, his father, and he feels him. And he says, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He didn't recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. And so he blessed him. But then we have one more question. He finally says, are you really my son Esau? And Jacob says, I am. So he's finally convinced his father that he is indeed who he is not. And the deception has worked remarkably. His mother did not think of the whole voice problem, but in the end, Isaac was convinced by the lies of his son, as well as by the smell and the feel of Jacob. Now, I was thinking about this, and you guys can give me your two cents here, but I've always liked the 22nd verse for reasons that are not immediately obvious. When Jacob came close to Isaac, his father, he felt him and said, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. I've often used that verse as a description of how we appear before our Heavenly Father. Because here we are not Christ. We are anything but Christ. But when we are presented to the Father, we are clothed in the garments of Christ. We are covered with his righteousness. We have become like him, our brother. He has made us. He has made us to be like himself. So that when we appear before the Father, we appear as one who is like our older brother, Christ. And in the strangest reversal of all, Christ is the one who receives the curse, and we are the one who receives the blessing. He's the one who receives the crucifixion, the one who receives the condemnation, the one who is cut off, the one who is forsaken, the one who is abandoned. And we, the undeserving ones, the liars, the ones who engage in deception all the time, who take the Lord's name in vain, who are complicit in all sorts of evil, we are the ones who get ahead. We are the ones who receive the blessing of the Father. And Christ is the one who receives the curse of the Father on the cross. So when I read that verse, I often connect it to who we are in Christ, our brother, that he has not been deceived, but rather he has willingly given to us his own clothing. He's clothed us in his own righteousness. We feel like him. We smell like him. We have become like him because he has taken us into himself. And all this he does quite willingly because, unlike Jacob and Esau, he loves us as brothers. And he was willing to take the curse upon himself in order that we, the undeserving ones, might receive the blessing and be the ones who are justified as if we are the firstborn himself.
I can compare myself to any other person on the earth, and I can find people that push me up the ladder a rung because their deeds are worse than mine. And of course, I'll find people that are better than me, and they can look at me and go, yeah, I deserve the blessing more than Brandon because I'm better than him. But really, if we're going to be honest here, like, who in all of history is most deserving, is most worthy? Well, there's no competition if we're comparing ourselves to Christ. I mean, he's going to win every time. He is the son in whom God is most pleased, well pleased. This is my beloved son in whom I am pleased. Listen to him. And the feel of the garments. And then later on in verse 27, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, so we've got the garment of Christ, the pleasing aroma of his sacrifice goes up before God, and we receive the same blessing that Christ receives.
I have often referred to the plan of salvation, the plan of redemption, as holy collusion.
That's a good phrase.
Yeah, and that's what it is. If this was to happen, if we were to do something like that, if we were to turn over and sacrifice, even if he did it willingly, an innocent person for the guilty everyone, we were to have them punished, and then we were to make all the guilty everyone look like this good person, because we made this innocent person look like these bad. We would cry foul for sure. All of our sensibilities would be horribly offended and say, "Well, no, you can't do that. That's not how this works." I mean, you can't have all the murderers and the thieves and everything like that. You can't let them all go because you dressed them up like this other guy, and you can't punish him just because you dressed him up like them. Like that's not how justice works. Okay. But this is what God does. He's got a Trinitarian holy collusion going on that takes place at the cross to get the guilty everyone off.
We do cry foul on this, even though it's God, the Trinity, pulling this off. We still want to call foul because, from our perspective, we're like, no, that can't be. Like, if I'm going to get in, I got to get in on my own merit. We can't be tricking God here. But God isn't. This isn't some trick God is playing on himself. God knows exactly what's going on, and he's intentionally doing it to get the guilty off. And it's like, and we can't just stand by and let it happen.
We
know better than God. Yeah, no, God, that isn't just.
Yeah, that's offense. That's the offense of the cross, man. You say like, no, that's not. You can't have other people paying for your stuff. No such thing as a free lunch. Certainly no such thing as a imputed record.
Yeah, there's a, when I was listening to you talk, I was thinking too, there's a further parallel here between the way this works and the way that the cross works and the imputation of Christ's righteousness to us. Because you look at this chapter, and I guess the overarching question in this chapter is, how could the blessing actually be given to the person that God desires to receive it, in the midst of all of this lying and deception and backstabbing and everything else evil that's taking place here? Because we're told early on, when Rebecca's pregnant with these boys, she's told that the older shall serve the younger. But when it comes right down to it, the way that this is accomplished is through evil, through sin, through lies, through all sorts of wickedness. But isn't that how our salvation was accomplished? You have Christ, who is betrayed by Judas, who's betrayed by Peter, who's abandoned by his disciples, who, of course, is unjustly convicted, who is an innocent man and yet is put to death as if he's guilty. So you have all of this sin, backstabbing, abandonment, deception going on at the crucifixion of Christ. And yet, through that, despite that, God is accomplishing the blessing of salvation for us. And that's the way that I see this, broadly speaking. I see this whole chapter. I don't make any excuses for Rebecca. I don't make any excuses for Jacob, for what they did. They were acting out of self-interest. They were acting out of wrong motives. And yet, despite all of this, God was able to give his blessing to the person that he said he was going to give it to the younger. And it's just like that with our salvation as well. You have all of this wickedness taking place in the crucifixion of Christ, and yet all of this happened according to the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, because this is the way that he was going to give his blessings to all of us.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe a little bit different different way of hearing this story for some folks, but that's the way that I like to read this this whole episode of Jacob and Esau.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that God reveals his, you know, his plan of salvation and things that we would, you know, things that we would look at and say, well, that's a bad thing right there. I mean, this isn't the only time he does that, you know, where it's like, well, no, that person is messing it up real bad. He still takes those things and says, you know what this is like? This is like what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Now we see this later in Genesis with, of course, with Joseph and his brothers. When he finally says to them, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good to bring about the saving of all these people. So you always have God's plan of salvation for us, which is accomplished even in the midst of this mess that takes place. That happens in our lives. It happens in the lives of the people in the Bible. God is dealing with sinful, messed up people, so there really is no other way. There's always going to be sin in the mix, but God is the kind of God who is able to accomplish his saving will for us despite that and even through the sinful actions of people, which is a really good thing because we don't have any other option. there is no way that we cannot act as we are. Sinners sin. That's what they do.
I'll tell you this too. When Esau gets back, he is going to be justly hacked off.
Yeah, and he is. He is. When he gets back, it's almost as if Jacob and Esau are passing each other. You can almost, because as soon as one ends, the next section begins. So Esau comes in. He prepares the game that he killed. He brings it. He says, you know, let my father arise and eat of his son's game that you may bless me. And his father asks him, who are you? And he says, I'm your son, your firstborn Esau. And it's at that point that Isaac trembles violently and realizes what has happened. And Esau is rightly, I mean, if there's ever righteous indignation, this is it. He is rightly angry because, as he says, is he not rightly called Jacob, for he has supplanted me these two times? He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. You know, like I mentioned before, Jacob's name means heel, but it's in the sense of like the one who grabs the heel, like one who's trying to yank somebody back to supplant them to get ahead. So he has earned his name. He's lived up to his name more than once. And actually, he'll continue to do this as his story unfolds.
Is it almost like impossible to not feel bad for Esau?
You know, I was thinking about this because when you read this, just trying to read it just simply as a story, if you can think of it apart from the biblical context, apart from being the inspired word of God, just as a story, the narrator tells this story in such a way that I think it betrays the sympathy that he feels for Esau, because he makes no excuses for what Isaac and what Rebekah and Jacob are doing. But he gives, and there's a lot of just of pathos. There's a lot of sympathy for Esau that's written into this account. Yeah, I feel terrible for him because he did what he was supposed to do. He was the firstborn, and he did what his dad told him to do, and yet his birthright is the blessing of the firstborn is taken away from him.
And maybe it's, you know, as you think in the context of, you know, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, and you're like, you add that on top of it, and you're like, man, like, by the way, God doesn't like you either.
Yeah, poor Esau. Poor Esau. You know, I was talking to a friend about that verse the other day about Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And, you know, it kind of fits with this whole messianic typology we talked about earlier with Christ being the one who's cut off. And he's cut off precisely in order that we might be adopted and brought into the family of God. It all kind of fits. You know, it's not ordinary to think of Esau as a Christ figure, but at least read in this way, I think it does fit.
Yeah.
But of course, as you know, as with any parallel, it's not perfect because Esau is none too happy about what's happened. In fact, he's so angry that he begins to plan how he's going to get revenge. His father does give him a sort of a blessing, I guess you could say, but it's certainly not the blessing of the firstborn. And the blessing of the firstborn is a verbal blessing that God is going to give him all sorts of agricultural richness and dominion over other peoples, dominion over his own family. But Esau doesn't get any of that. He doesn't get those blessings. He doesn't get the double inheritance that Jacob is going to get. So he bears a grudge, verse 41, bears a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And so Esau says to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." The first two brothers over again, Cain and Abel.
Yeah, yeah. Even that's a little bit commendable. He's like, "My dad's going to die soon, so I'm not going to kill my brother while he's still alive because he'll be upset about that." And my father is worth mourning.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, that's thoughtful. But man, the second he's gone.
The second the days of mourning are over, we're going to have another funeral.
Yeah, Jacob will quick be joining him.
Yes. I will send my brother to be with my father.
Yeah, dude. And Jacob, we'll see. I mean, Jacob is rightly freaked out about this happening. And you should be.
Yeah, he believes, as does his mother. He believes every word that his brother says. So Rebecca finds out about what's going on, and she calls Jacob and she says, "Look, Esau is very ticked. He's planning on killing you. So here's what I want you to do. Run away. Get out of here. Go stay with my relatives." And there's a bit of humor here because she says, "Stay with my relatives a few days until your brother's fury subsides." Well, it's like 20 years before he comes back. So a few days lengthens into much longer, but to get to that next episode.
Yeah. What you always want is a master hunter after you.
Yeah. Yeah. Just what you want. Some guy who's obviously good with a bow to want to kill you.
Tracking stuff down. That's exactly who I want. That's who I want after me.
Yeah. So he better hightail it while he has a chance.
It's interesting. Why couldn't Isaac have simply taken the word back? You know, today we think, "Oh, I made an oopsie. I take it back. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that." But here, the word comes out. The word is spoken, and it is. It's simply, I've given him your blessing. You know, he's going to be the Lord over you. Like, what in the world, Dad? Like, but don't you have something else for me?
No, nope, yeah, it's something else. Yeah. And, you know, Esau realizes this because he doesn't say, "Can't you take back the blessing?" He says, "Don't you have another blessing?" When this word of blessing the father speaks has the divine imprimatur upon it. So these words are not only the words of Isaac, but they're also the words of God. And when the words of God are spoken, they are irrevocable. So what they speak into existence is and cannot be altered. So this blessing can no more be undone than one can be unbaptized. So what is blessed, just like the one who is baptized is baptized.
Yeah.
Not the attitude of the recipient that matters, but it is the fidelity and the power of the one who speaks it.
Yeah, yeah. God says that you're righteous. End of story.
Yeah, end of story.
And that is the end of the story for us today. So we will be back next week, guys. Thanks for hanging out with us.